Hello, and welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local and innovative public radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And from that oasis of thought, they migrate to this oasis of the air, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. And go check that blog out today, because it gives you a way to join this special program of Philosophy Talk, John.
That's right. This is a special program. Normally, we take a topic, we examine it philosophically. We have a guest that helps us. Today, you're the guest, and you get to decide the topic or topics we're going to discuss. What's on your mind these days? What do you want to hear philosophers discuss? What do you want to talk about philosophically? What big philosophical problem is keeping you awake at night? Give us a call.
Yeah, we're calling it a Philosophy Talk shout-out. And here are the three ways to join us. You can call in at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Second way to join in, you can send us an email at comments@philosophytalk.org. comments@philosophytalk.org. And last but not least, you can go to our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where I've got a blog started called Shout-Out Now. And go there, and you can post a comment. We're monitoring those comments, and we'll get some of them on the air.
So, Ken, we're going to have people calling. By the way, that's 415-841-4134. Maybe we should start, though, by saying, what do we mean by philosophy talk? I mean, there's a little ambiguity there, isn't it? I mean, do we mean talk about philosophy, about free will, Descartes, Aristotle, John Rawls, all the great philosophical issues and personalities, or do we mean just talking philosophically about everything, sitting on our rocking chair, chewing our gum, and philosophizing?
Well, we mean both those things. We also mean a third thing, because you and I get to be the voice of philosophy, and through us, philosophy talks to the world, right?
Oh,
so that's
cool,
that's the third thing. But I think we mean both those things. We get to talk about the great philosophical problems and the great philosophers, Descartes, Hume, Kant, Foucault, on the air, and free will, other minds. But you know what? I think you can make philosophy out of anything. So we can talk about anything. Our topics are potentially everything, because everything can be approached philosophically. Don't you agree?
Well, I don't know. That's a pretty big claim. Let me see if I can give you a problem here. Okay, here's I'm sitting here drinking coffee. How about the coffee in my coffee cup? Talk philosophically about that, big shot.
Okay, look, your coffee has that dark brown color that makes it look so appealing. Where is the color? Is the color in the coffee? Or is it merely in your perception of the coffee? Would a differently situated perceiver perceive it the same color or not? And the taste of the coffee, that lovely taste that's so soothing and refreshing and invigorating, is that in the coffee or merely in your taste bud? Is it subjective or objective? So there you go. I just talked about the coffee philosophically.
Okay, I agree. Everything could be talked about philosophically. We would even talk about the coffee cup philosophically. Is it essential that it have a handle? Is it essential that it have a certain use? How about the big philosophical problems? What makes them so special?
What makes them so special? Well, you know, I think of philosophy problems are a special kind of problem in one way, because they're how possibly questions, right? Aristotle said a long time ago, it's owing to wonder that men first began to philosophize. And I think he's right. We do philosophy when we're deeply puzzled. You think, free will. I know I have free will. It feels like I have free will. But then you start to wonder, given that I'm a material being, I'm genetically determined, I'm conditioned by my culture and upbringing, how possibly could I have free will? And that's when you start philosophizing, when you start wondering, how possibly could it be?
And you know, people often ask me, I mean, why philosophize? Philosophy bakes no bread. I don't think philosophy is all that impractical. It often has practical relevance, but I don't think that's the basic answer. I think the basic answer is at least most of us, or some of us, or a lot of us have this philosophy gene. We're just interested in these basic issues about human existence, and to tell us not to philosophize would be like telling us not to eat or breathe.
There you go. And our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Cornelli, visited a local coffee shop, speaking of coffee, where she encountered lots of people with the philosophy gene. She files this report.
The Canvas Cafe and Gallery in San Francisco's Sunset District is home to all kinds of newspaper reading, latte sipping, laptop staring intellectuals. I disrupted their activities briefly one afternoon to turn their attention to a very important topic, philosophy. What is it, and why is it useful? Here's what they had to say.
I think philosophy as a way to look at the world. philosophy is a formal school of thought.
It's a belief, and definitely a belief in attitude.
I would define it as a department at college.
You know, how you live. To me, that is philosophy.
A subcategory of academic discourse. That's how I define it.
People trying to think deeper thoughts than just face value.
I think it involves a lot of reading.
I studied it for a long time, and I thought I would find the meaning of life. And I didn't find the meaning of life, but I found out how to argue really well.
I think it's useful to philosophers, at least the ones with jobs.
Well, it's like anything else, it's a synopsis of previous experience. So the idea is to learn from previous experience rather than having to like just create your own experiences and learn from that de novo, reinventing the wheel every time.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Corneli.
I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And today we're having a Philosophy Talk shout-out. And here's a way for you to join in the fun and shout out your philosophical concerns to us. There's three ways. You can dial 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can send us email via comments@philosophytalk.org. That's comments@philosophytalk.org. Or last but not least, you can go to our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, and post a comment on the Shout Out Now blog. We're monitoring the comments there, and we'll take your comments. That way you can shout out to the world. John, what do you think about that?
I think that's great. And while we're waiting for some shouters, let me ask you a question, Ken. I heard a rumor about you that you got into philosophy because your parents were dead set against you doing anything useful with your life. They didn't want you to be a lawyer or a doctor or a merchant or a chief. They wanted you to be a philosopher. Is that right?
You got that completely wrong. I went to college to be an electrical engineer, and my parents were really proud I was going to be an electrical engineer. Then I discovered I didn't want to be an engineer. I thought, okay, I'll try mathematics. Then I discovered I wasn't good enough to be a mathematician. Then I got this great books program, and my dad said, what are you going to do with the great books? And I said, oh, I don't know. I'll be a lawyer, Dad. And then I discovered I didn't want to be a lawyer. One of my teachers said, go be a philosopher, Ken. I said, huh? Oh, okay. I went and became a philosopher. I told my dad, you know what he said? He said, my son, the philosopher? How's that sound? What am I going to tell my friends? My son, the philosopher? So no, that's not what they wanted for me.
Oh, it reminds me of a Frasier episode, you know. You can imagine your dad going down to the local bar and telling his cohorts, yeah, my son's going to be a philosopher.
How did you get into philosophy? How did you get into
philosophy? How did I get into philosophy? Well, you know, I wasn't the world's greatest high school student, and I mostly went to college to try to find a college that was small enough that I could make the football team. And I didn't succeed. After my freshman year, the coach put his arm around me and he said, Perry, you're small, but you're slow. Why don't you go, you know, focus on academics? So I did, and I discovered I loved college. I wanted to be a college teacher. That's what I decided first. The question was what to teach. Philosophy was really the only thing I could do very well. In those days, you had to have 3x5 cars and keep them organized. I couldn't do that.
And you're still doing it now, John. You're still doing it really well now.
Yeah.
If I dare say so myself.
Two decisions I made my sophomore year in college. So, one was to get married to my wonderful wife, and one was to major in philosophy. And 45 years later, they're both working out very well.
There you go. Well, you know what? We've got some callers already wanting to join this shout-out. Michael in Los Angeles, all the way down in Los Angeles. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Michael. We're really glad to have you aboard.
It's an honor to be here.
Well, thank you. So what do you want to shout-out to us about?
I want to shout-out about the very topic of philosophy itself. I mean, what is it to be a philosopher? What is philosophizing itself? And I have my own comment on that, but I want to hear two of you talk about it first, because
you don't want to tell us first what you think, and then we'll tell you what we think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What I think is that, I mean, I had a talk with a middle school student who was fascinated about the extraterrestrial aliens, and I started wondering, if you're interested in outer space, why aren't you interested in yourself first? I mean, I think the first step into philosophy is the introspective point of view where you have when you're interested about yourself, and then started thinking about questions about yourself instead of being fascinated by outside. And then philosophy just manifests itself through this introspective jumping higher a level than yourself by looking at yourself and then jumping another level higher because the reason that I would like to talk about this jumping higher and higher is that I read a book by Douglas Hofstadter. It's called Gerda Lasher Bach.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if you guys have heard of this.
Oh, yeah. Popular, widely read book in our circles.
Yeah. The main theme in his book is that we have this hierarchical, semantical system built into our consciousness. And that's what he refers to as consciousness, as this uniquely human talent that we have of just jumping out of level that we are in. I mean, we can think about the physical system, and we can think about ourselves thinking about the physical system. I mean, Gödel himself can think about mathematics, and then after a while, he's doing mathematics where he views numbering itself to test the number theory.
I like that conception of philosophy. I mean, I distinguish between experience, which I think is something that is not unique to humans. I think a lot of animals have experience, and who knows exactly where the drop off is. I don't know if lobsters experience things, but I'm pretty sure even cats do, and I know dogs do. But then consciousness, I think of as being able to think about your own experience. And the natural thing that we think about is not our own experience, but the external world. We know what it's like to be in a world with a desk, to be in a world with food in front of us, so forth and so on. But I think you're right. You really start to get philosophical when you notice that you're not only in a world with all these other things in it that might be useful to you, you're in a world with you in it, and you're in a world with your own mental states in it. There's something it's like to be you. There's something it's like to be in various of your brain states. And I think that's, if not the only way into philosophy, it's a main way that people get into philosophy. That's why so many intro courses start with Descartes' Meditations, which is this famous book that starts with a question: how do I know that there's anything besides me in the universe?
Michael and John, I think you're both onto something deep and important. I don't want to pile on, but I do think it's really important, though, because here's what's a thing that human beings have. I like to call it a capacity for critical self-reflection. Right? We reflect on ourselves, and we reflect with a critical attitude, and we do that. We do that, and that's the really important thing, and I do think it's part of the genesis of philosophy. So thanks for the call all the way from Los Angeles for the shout-out, Michael. We've got another caller, Dusty Morloco in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dusty. What do you want to shout-out to us?
Hello, good morning. I have a question for you, I was hoping. I want to know, what role should philosophers play in forming political decisions? Or politics in general, I guess. And what role have they played in the past?
Well, let me ask you the question. I'm going to turn this on you.
Sure.
What do you think? What role do you think philosophers should play? I got to tell you the answer to the factual question. We haven't played much of a role, but do you think we should play a big role?
Well, I'm not a philosopher myself, I wouldn't say, except as an amateur. I like it. But I have friends that are, mm-hmm. and I think they're critical thinkers. They weigh evidence carefully, and I like that. It seems like a reasonable thing to have them be part of the decision-making process of how we run our world.
Yeah, you know what Plato said about this, don't you?
Yeah, I have read Plato.
Yeah, the world will, our cities will not be well governed until kings become philosophers and philosophers become king. John, you're chafing over there. You want to add something really?
Well, I don't know. He was probably right that they won't become good places until that. But the question is even if that happens, will they become very good places? I think philosophers have an important role to play that they should play a larger role in, and that. That's doing what philosophers do best, ask how do we know something and what does it mean? Those jobs usually now fall to lawyers. We have a tremendously lawyer-driven political system in the United States. Almost all of our Congress people are lawyers, and our presidents have tended to be lawyers. They surround themselves with lawyers, and lawyers are wonderful people, and they've gotten a certain kind of training that's very valuable. But I think when you reach to the highest levels, when you reach to the Supreme Court, when you reach to the executive branch, you need to be thinking not just about kind of what how do we operate within the existing law, but what really are the possibilities? What are the meanings? What are the reasons for doing things? And I'd like to see, I wouldn't really like to see philosophers be in charge, but I'd like to see philosophers on the Supreme Court. I'd like to see philosophers in the president's cabinet.
You're listening to a philosophy talk shout out. It's a chance for you to be heard on the radio and to speak out in a philosophical forum.
It's a philosophy talk shout out. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We've got a bunch of emails now, John. Are you going to read an email or two to us?
Yeah, here's one from Louie in Oakland, and it says, here's my shout out. Humans have spoken language for about 200,000 years, but they've had written language only for the last 5,000 or so. How would human civilization, or at least philosophy, be different without written language? What do you think, Ken?
Well, there would be a lot fewer tomes of philosophy.
Yeah, there would be a lot less to read, that's for sure.
Yeah, so in one way it would be, I think there was a time in academic philosophy. I don't know if you folks know this. There was a time in academic philosophy when you could become a really famous philosopher without having written much of anything.
Like Socrates.
Well, yeah, but that goes way back. But no, in the 20th century, there are all these famous philosophers. Rogers Albritton wrote maybe two or three or four articles his entire lifetime. But he was a famous talker. He was a famous philosophical conversationalist. I actually think that philosophy is made for the cafe. I do my best philosophy work in the cafe, talking to other people. So if we had never invented writing, I think I'd be more famous.
Well, that could be, although you publish quite a bit, yeah. Ken. But, even if philosophers didn't publish things, still, I think a lot of the problems that they think about would not exist without the structures provided by written language. I think the emailer has a very good point that what I like to call information games. We have these different ways of picking up information and getting it to for our own use later on with memory or to other people, and that's language. But written language just provided an incredible revolutionary change in the possibilities that were available there. You can now get information from 200 years ago or 2,000 years ago. You can send information around the world, and you can take the insights and the ideas and record them for people much later to think about. And without that whole structure that was built up by written language, I don't know that there would be much philosophy at all.
Well, there wouldn't be all this storehouse of great works and all this reaction to it. That's certainly true, It's certainly true. We'd like you to join in on this philosophical shout-out, folks in the audience. The number, you can do this in three ways. You can call 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. It's comments@philosophytalk.org. Or last but not least, you can go to our blog and post a comment on our blog page there.
And we got another email. This is from Edna in San Francisco. She says, I have a question that goes back to the What is Art show you did with Alexander Nehemus. Well, that's good. Edna's a good listener to remember that great show. It seems impossible to define art because whatever definition you come up with, some museum curator will just put something in a museum that defies the definition, like a toilet, for example. So how is it possible for people to talk informatively using the word art if the word is impossible to define?
This goes back to the answer we gave on that show, and it's a correct answer, I think, is that there are no necessary and sufficient conditions for something to be art. It's what Wittgenstein, I know you're not a big fan of Wittgenstein, John, but it's what Wittgenstein called a family resemblance concept, right? The class of all things that count as art is a loosely connected class with all these overlapping similarities and differences, just like the class of all things that we call games, right? John, what do you think about that thought?
Well, I think that's true as a general point about concepts. They tend to be open-ended. They have not just these necessary and sufficient conditions, but these functional things. And that's true of art like everything else. But I think the reader or the emailer makes a point that can be a little bit irritating about art. I mean, what exactly? Because art isn't just, it's not like, you know, here's a new kind of teacup or something. It's like, here's a new thing that belongs in the museum and we ought to sit around and think great thoughts about the person who did it, and it turns out to be a toilet bowl. I mean, there is something that gives you the sense, is this fraud? I don't know. We'll have to get Nahema's back and get the bottom line about this.
We've got some folks who want to join the shout-out. Richard in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Richard.
Hi. I'm trying to be a painter. And one of the rules that I follow is the more you look, the more you see. And that works as far as a painter goes. But it seems to me that the question is, the more you see, you know, what is the next step? And I'm wondering if that would fall in your philosophy department.
I'm trying to figure out what the puzzle is here. The more you look, the more you see, but then you mm-hmm. think somehow seeing, it's like you can't see the forest for the trees kind of thing? Is that?
No, I think it should lead to something. You're, in a way, when you're seeing, you're analyzing, or you're exploring, you're awakening to something.
All this sounds true. I'm not sure I'm getting the puzzlement. It sounds right what you're saying. Are you getting the puzzlement, John?
I'd like to hear just a little bit more about it. Give us two more sentences.
Well, two more sentences would be, I guess, the purpose are really where graphic, it also has to be graphic, and you're dealing with ideas. What ideas should you deal with?
Well, here's the thing I think, Richard, about art. Maybe it's an old-fashioned thing about art. And you might tell me this. There's ideas in art. There's a couple different things, I think, given what you said. First of all, I like art that's beautiful. I like art that's just visually or orally or some way or centrally arresting. I want to be grabbed by a work of art, first through the senses. And then there's a lot of conceptual art, and people want to, you know, they want to communicate ideas through art, and I love ideas. I'm a man of ideas, so don't get me wrong. I love ideas, but I love the beauty first, the visual aesthetic pleasure of the thing first, and I think of the ideas as coming second. I don't know.
But Ken, I mean, beauty is just one thing, and the reaction be just one emotional reaction. Shouldn't art be involved with not just beauty, but ugliness, shock, all the different emotions that can come out of the spoken word or the graphic display or the moving arts? Why is beauty and the nice emotions given a privileged position?
I agree with you. I actually wrote on a blog a long time ago a thing about haunting beauty. You know, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're having a shout-out, and we want you to join us. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or as always, you can send us an email, comments@philosophytalk.org. Or as unusual, you can post on our blog. And we've got a caller on the line now, John in Berkeley, another caller from Berkeley. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, John.
Good morning, my first time.
Well, welcome.
Great. I'd like to talk about the idea of deep ecology. I'm sure you're familiar. This is being posted by Gary Snyder and others that environmentalism is just a stopgap measure, and we have to go a step further. And what they believe in is the idea of rethinking where you live. You become native to the place. You don't think of yourself as somebody from someplace else, but rather you are becoming a native of where you live, sort of like turning your back on Europe and developing a new culture, because America is just basically a transplanted European culture. And I'd like to have your thoughts on that. Thanks.
Well, you know, one of the heroes of the deep ecology movement is the Norwegian philosopher Arne Næss, a great man who's been involved in lots of philosophical enterprises. I like deep ecology. I think in a way it's right, but probably hopeless. I mean, I think the world would probably be much better off if we... I mean, talk about the world here, not necessarily the people in it, the people that happen to be alive to debate, but the world, the earth, as a kind of a continuing thing that gives rise to life and possibility would probably last a lot longer and be in a lot better shape if people didn't have this conception of themselves as citizens of the world, but thought of themselves as caretakers of some little plot of ground But I suspect Ken finds this repulsive.
No, I don't find it at all repulsive. I don't find many things repulsive. I find it intriguing. Actually, I love the Earth, and I think we are treating the Earth like a very, very, very unloved child. And this deep ecology, this local idea, right, live where you are. When I first came to California, you know what I first thought about California was? I thought, gosh, these people live out of sync with their environment. I was in Southern California at the time when I had these thoughts. They have all these green things, and they're basically, it wants to be a desert, and they've got to get all this water around here. They want to, it's a desert. Let it be a desert. Respect the rhythm of nature. So I don't disagree with this thought.
Yeah, you think L.A. is bad. You ought to go to Phoenix where, you know, it's just it's just crazy. But you know, with one nice thing about the internet and about the possibilities today is travel isn't as necessary to get to broaden your intellectual horizons as it used to be. Philosophers still travel all over the world to give conferences and talks to people, and so do a lot of other people. But a lot of that is now getting unnecessary.
Join our philosophical shout out 415-841-4134. And Reed in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Reed.
Hello.
So what's your comment or question? What do you want to shout out?
That there should be a philosopher on the Supreme Court. It's always struck me that Supreme Court opinions, when they go beyond maybe what might be an obvious application of case law, are in fact philosophy and practical philosophy. And I'm wondering if you have ever, as a philosopher, read Supreme Court opinions with that in mind.
Yes, I haven't read them extensively, but I have read some of them and excerpts from others of them, and I think you're exactly right. You know, it wasn't always the case that the Supreme Court was reserved for lawyers or people with a lot of judicial experience. That's probably fixed into the system now because we insist that the bar and everybody pass on Supreme Court justices. But what's really called for on the Supreme Court is decisions about concepts, about the extension of concepts like freedom, rape, life, privacy. And things get to the Supreme Court exactly because they're not already settled in ways that can just be looked up in law books. And I think that's a great place for philosophers.
There's a recent Supreme Court decision about some guy was got an extra penalty because the law says you can't use a gun in the commission of a crime. And he didn't use a gun as a weapon, but he used it to do something weird.
He traded the gun for some dope.
Yeah, that's what it was. he traded the gun for the dope. And there was a big debate of whether that counted as using a gun. And the court came down and decided that it did count as using a gun. And it seems to me they needed a little philosophy of language there.
There they had Scalia was the most philosophical one, and he argued that, no, that's not what was meant by using a gun. O'Connor and some of the more practical ones just, I think, wanted to put the guy away. And so they argued it was using a gun.
So we're having a philosophical shout-out, and we'd like you to join in on 415-841-4134 or send us comments at philosophytalk.org or log on to our blog. Keith in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Keith.
Thank you. Yes, I'd like to hearken back to the logical positivism program where you talked about Karl Popper, and I'm interested in talking about proof and some of its ramifications.
Okay,
so here I go. Some things are easy to prove. What is this rock made of? And some things really can't be proven easily. I love my wife and kids. I like chocolate.
Oh, you can prove that
well,
easily.
Okay. Don't give me a hard time here.
Okay, sorry.
At least yet. Anyway, does it then make sense to only debate issues which are hard to prove or take a long time to do so? And if so, what sort of things would be like that? A very complex mathematical theorem? Okay, and then the second part is related to that, going to sort of ramifications of these ideas in the political and social sphere. Do you folks believe that there'll be non-trivial, non-provable political and social issues which will essentially always be with us? And if so, what would some of these be?
Keith, you've asked a lot. And
I know.
We're gonna have to save the answers to your questions until after the break, because we're coming up on a break here. So we'll take up your questions after the break. You're listening to a Philosophy Talk shout out, folks, and we'd like you to join in.
Well, You know you make me wanna shout, kick my heels up and shout, throw my hands up and shout, throw my head back and shout. Come on now, don't forget to say you will. Don't forget to say yeah.
Say you will.
Say it right now, baby.
Say you will.
Come on, come on.
Say you will.
Say it better yet.
Say you will.
Come on now.
Say
that.
It's a shout out. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're having a Philosophy Talk shout out with you, our listeners. And you've been shouting out a lot. We've got a bunch of emails there, right, John?
Well, let's pick up on Keith, though. Keith was talking to us about proof. And he was asking, well, when do we need proof? What's proof all about? And will we ever have proof for things in the political and ethical sphere? So what do we think about proof? Well, I mean, proof contrasts to other ways of learning something. Sometimes you can just see something. Sometimes you can just intuit something. Sometimes mathematicians think something is obvious or axiomatic. Proofs come in to fill the gap between that and further knowledge. But frankly, proof is very seldom, in my opinion, a way of learning things. It's a way of kind of making clear and clarifying what you know, at least in logic and mathematics. Usually people have a pretty good idea of what's true. The proof allows them to see exactly what concepts are involved and how it works. And in that sense, I think we will have proofs in ethics and political philosophy, but of course they'll always be based on assumptions that may be questionable.
Well, there you go, right, because that's really important. Keith, I know you're still with us, but look, mathematical proof is typically, let's call it deductive proof. You got a bunch of axioms or premises and you deduce a conclusion. And just as John was saying, in the conclusion, there's really nothing that you didn't start out with, right? You don't end up with something that wasn't already kind of implicit in your starting points. But the kind of issues you were talking about, you know, political issues and all that, they're not amenable to that kind of proof. And most of life is not amenable to that kind of proof. Most of life is not like, prove it absolutely, indubitably. It's mostly give me kind of the force of the better reason. It's weighing one side versus the other. So life is complicated and mostly doesn't give us deductive proof.
Most change of opinion comes from generations who hold the other opinion dying, and people getting tired of arguing. But proof has its role too.
So you got to let's go to.
I got a pile of emails. Let me read through a bunch of them. First, one of our friends, Paul in San Francisco, would like to thank his grandma Phoebe. Before he ever heard of Socrates, the best role model for the love of wisdom was her. Thanks, Grandma, wherever you are. Well, what a nice tribute to his philosophical grandmother from Paul. Barbara in San Mateo, is Pluto a planet or not? Seems like the word planet must be ambiguous, like bank. We'll come back to that.
We will.
Yeah. What does philosophy have to say? This is from A.Y., somewhere or other. What does philosophy have to say about the question of what love is, whether love is that platonic idea that we're split beings looking for their half to make us complete, or whether love is just about pleasure, physical, mental, culinary, or whether love is the creation of some new third thing? And finally, another short one, is there a correlation of philosophical education to civilized behavior? If so, and why? Please say hello to Robert for me. This is from Lee Dawson.
Well, yeah, those are a lot of questions there, John.
Well, that's a former student of our student, Robert Jones. Okay.
You know what? We'll take some of these topics and make future shows out of them. You know, and there's tons of stuff there. I don't think we could possibly answer it all. But I'm going to talk about philosophy and civilized behavior just for a second. You know, one of the most philosophical cultures in the world is Germany, right? And one of the highest cultures in the world, and I am a great admirer of German culture, German idealism. But, you know, the role of philosophy in German culture did not stop them from making dark turns in some of the periods of their history. Same, America is not the most philosophical culture in the world. We've made some dark turns of our own, not many is quite as dark as that, although the slavery days were pretty dark. I mean, you know, if philosophy could control culture, maybe culture would, you know, civilized behavior would follow. But Philosophy is just one influence among others.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. I think it's often a good influence, but philosophy is like law. It can be used to make the true appear the true or to make the true appear the false. And it just depends on who's doing the philosophy.
Yeah, more shouters. Stephanie in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Stephanie. What do you want to shout out to us?
Well, what I want to... my question to you is this. Specifically in the case or the example of sexual harassment in the workplace, you know, it's not always a viable option to sue your employer. And unless you win that lawsuit, that's really not a good idea. It's kind of a rotten experience. And you also get a reputation, and it's hard to get a job after that. So, you know, in my case, I quit my job. But so what does one do when none of the options seem viable? Because a law does not change someone's mind about what's acceptable behavior in the workplace, especially if you're an industry that's, you know, 85% male-dominated.
What industry are you in, Stephanie?
I am a software architect.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So engineering is really dominated by males, and that's not the best thing in the world.
My parents keep telling me that.
Wait, hey, but, you know, this is you're asking a really tough question, and I have to think about it pretty hard to give you an answer I'd be happy letting the world hear. But you're asking a very tough question. You know, you don't want to use the recourses of the law. I mean, it's a shame that when the law makes it hard for you to... I mean, the law is supposed to be about justice and all this stuff. When we had a show about lawyers, we talked about a defense attorney who defends his client or her client by brutally cross-examining the accuser in a rape case. And we had we interviewed a woman who just couldn't continue being a defense attorney because of that. And you know, it's really tough stuff, and it's complicated and hard. And I wish I could give you a nugget of advice that just came out of my philosophical wisdom, but I don't think I have one instantly.
Well, one thing you want to do though is you want to kind of make sure that you aren't having a kind of artificially restricted look at the possibilities. It is very difficult. You feel you've been put upon. You're being sexually harassed. It doesn't rise to the level, perhaps, whether you can call in the law. It would be very risky to start some kind of complaint process, or maybe you feel that it would. Are there other options? Well, I would say the first question is this endemic throughout the whole division you're working for, or the whole group you're working for? In which case, maybe the best option is to look somewhere else for a job. But if it's just one or two guys, the solution may not be to go to the boss, but to go to your other coworkers and say, are you really comfortable with the way they treat me?
Shame.
I was the only female in a 30-employee company, if that just gives you an idea, the only full-time female.
Stephanie, I'll tell you what we should do. You should call us back. We should get your name and number. We should have a conundrum. And then we can talk to you at some length and edit it down to a nugget of wisdom.
Yeah,
because this is a hard one. And we'd want to spend 10, 15 minutes, okay?
When we do a conundrum, we can edit out the really bad ideas we come up with.
But this is a good example of a conundrum, folks, and we love these kind of puzzles, and we think hard about them, but I can't solve this one for you right now, Stephanie. It's a really hard one. Paul in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Paul.
In a previous program, I think, John Perry, you described yourself as a logical positivist.
Did I? Well,
I don't think so, John.
Well, no, I'm sort of a logical positivist. But go ahead. What's up?
Okay. I prefer the term logical empiricism. Anyway, I'm sort of in that school of thought. Okay. My understanding is one of the features of logical empiricism or positivism is that absolute value judgments, either in the areas of ethics and aesthetics, have no validity. In other words, there's no way of demonstrating that certain actions are morally right or wrong. And the German sociologist Max Weber, I remember reading a paper in college, he wrote a paper on value judgments versus preference statements. And he argued that in the sciences, we can't make value judgments, but we can make preference statements. So I was wondering what your views are on that.
Well, I do think of myself as a logical empiricist, but I don't know. It seems to me I don't regard my views as forming a coherent whole, and I don't know why they should. And I'll tell you this. It's wrong to torture innocent children. Start with that, right? It's wrong to produce pain in innocent beings. That seems to me about as obvious as that 2 + 2 = 4. And so when people get all worried about the logical status of ethic statements and the fact that you can't get values out of facts and so forth and so on, that's all good. It's all interesting philosophically, but it shouldn't blind us to the fact that some things are about as obvious as can be in the ethical sphere.
John, you know, you and I actually, this is something we deeply disagree about. I'm a moral relativist. I hate to announce, I don't usually like to announce my own philosophical views on the air, but I'm a moral relativist, and I don't think any of those things are obvious. But you know what, Paul, we're going to do a show in a few weeks, I can't remember exactly when, on where morality comes from. And there are all kinds of different views. Some people think it comes from God's divine commandment. Some people think that there are just these basic intuitions, like John says, that certain things are morally right or morally wrong, and it's just kind of brute. There are other people who think the logical positivists didn't really want to say you couldn't have right or wrong. They really wanted to understand kind of the logic of moral judgments, and they thought complicated things, but one thing they thought is that when you said something was wrong, you weren't reporting a fact. You were expressing your attitude of distaste or approval of it. So it was all about expressing an attitude rather than reporting a fact. But this is all complicated, fascinating stuff. And we're going to have a show about just these topics. So Paul, you ask a good question. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, no, I hope in our next, we're coming up on a break now. I hope in our next segment we get some calls from little places. We've had lots of calls from big places. How about Clear Lake? I wonder if we're going to get a call from Clear Lake.
Well, we're going to do some business here, and we're going to tell you this is a special shout-out edition of Philosophy Talk. And joining us now to help tell us how to keep this lovely program and this station going is Matt Martin, General Manager of KALW.
Hey, thanks so much, Ken. You know, we decided to bring Philosophy Talk to Sunday mornings because we thought this was a good place for thoughtful, considered, open discussions about things that matter. And also, it's kind of a casual, nice feel that John and Ken bring to this program in this time of the day. If you're one of the people who's found that here, now is the one time during this Spring Express Drive for you to show your support for Philosophy Talk. Make a call at 800-525-9917, 800-525-9917. If you appreciate an open line to philosophers where you can expect that they know the difference between logical empiricism and logical positivism, or if you don't know the difference, you want to eavesdrop on that conversation, now's the time to show your support. 800-525-9917.
And for all you folks, like, we have a caller from L.A. today. And
yeah.
We often have callers from all over the place, and I know that people listen online. You can go to www.kalw.org and click on Donate Now. And even if you're outside the Bay Area, you can keep this lovely station going. I got to tell you, this is a lovely station, without which Philosophy Talk would not exist, because this is a risk-taking, innovative station, and we're so grateful for its support, but it needs your support.
And I do want to let folks know, if you're a Philosophy Talk fan, you'd like to show your support for Philosophy Talk in the form of a shirt. For an $80 pledge, we will send you a Philosophy Talk t-shirt, and we also have, if you can go a little higher in your support, if you've got the means and you love a program like Philosophy Talk, there's a Philosophy Talk salon coming up Sunday, June 10th, and if you'd like to have a seat at the table, we would love to have you there. John, you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, no, I was going to talk about the t-shirt. I was going to say that t-shirt was designed by my granddaughter. It's worth every penny.
Our slogan.
Get out there. It's got our slogan on it. Get out there and get that t-shirt. The salon will be great. We think we have a really good guest lined up. We don't have it quite nailed down, so we can't announce it, but everybody who signs up will be thrilled when they find out who it is.
And this guest works. It's going to be great. This is a San Francisco institution, this guest. So.
But we know the two of you will be there. We know there's going to be some great discussion no matter what.
Our whole team will be there. Ian Scholes, our roving philosophical reporter. You get to meet the behind-the-scenes people who toil every day on this lovely program. So come, it'll be a great time. We'll have some food, fun, and philosophy. For $175 for a thing?
For $175, you can have one place at the table. If you can go up to $300, you and a friend, you and a family member, you and someone you just meet off the street, come and talk philosophy with John and Ken and the team.
Wow, what a bargain.
800-525-9917 or online at kalw.org.
1-800-525-9917. Donate to this station. I got to tell you, we developed Philosophy Talk, and we took it around to different stations, and people said, philosophy on the radio? Come on. People don't want to hear philosophy on the radio. And we took it to Matt's predecessor, Nicole Sawaya, and she said, philosophy on the radio? What a cool idea. We have such bright, curious listeners. I'm sure they're hungry for something like this. And then Matt said, when he took over, he said, yeah, we're going to keep doing Philosophy Talk.
Absolutely.
So this station takes risk, innovates, and you've got to reward it. 1-800-525-9917.
You know, we've had a couple of these salons in the past, and they're such great occasions where Ken and I meet the listeners at KALW, and they are fascinating. You are fascinating people. And we really appreciate these occasions, and they've all turned out well, been a lot of fun. I think people have thought they were quite worthwhile. So 800-525-9917, and sign up for the salon on June 10th.
$175 for one seat at the table, $300 for two, and if you don't want to give at that level, we hope you can, but if you can't give at that level, anything you can give, we appreciate here. And if you like one of our cool T-shirts that says Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything, and then on the back, accept your intelligence. It's a conversation starter. Somebody sees your back, accept your intelligence. They want you to turn around and see what that is, and then you get to start a conversation, a philosophical conversation.
Ken, speaking of conversations, I have talked to so many KALW listeners who say, oh, Philosophy Talk, that's one of the shows I really love on your station. It's one of the programs that sets us apart here, because it's we say, we'll dig into an ideas, we'll spend an hour talking about legal ethics, or talking about moral dilemmas, or philosophy and what it means for neuroscience. These are all subjects that John and Ken have tackled since the last time we asked for your support. We only come to you twice a year. We need you to make your support for Philosophy Talk clear. At any level, you'll be saying, yes, I believe in programming like this. I want to keep it on the air at my local public radio station. 800-525-9917.
That's 1-800-525-9917. And I got to tell you, we do all the great philosophical topics, the great philosophers, but we really also want to dig in and see the philosophy underneath everyday life. Philosophy and baseball. You know, the Supreme Court, the environment. We want to bring a philosophical eye to all the issues that are on your mind, and we want to have a conversation with you. You're an important part of this conversation, and to keep that conversation going, we need your support. $80 for a T-shirt, $300 for a pair of seats at our salon. That's Sunday, June 10th at 1 o'clock at a lovely place in the Castro. 1-800-525-9917.
And all you folks out there listening on the internet, if you like the show, you owe a little bit to KALW. So go to our website. It's easy to figure out how to donate. And even if it's just $10, you're a student out there, and you wake up Sunday morning or Sunday afternoon, and you listen to Philosophy Talk, and why not help the station that makes it possible?